Many patients are upset to learn that doctors don't take the Hippocratic Oath anymore.
National Review columnist Wesley Smith talking about his presentation at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That's a real shame because the Hippocratic Oath protects patient safety. The speech I will give at the conference will describe the consequences of violating Hippocratic values in healthcare and the things that can occur in the healthcare system if we move away from Hippocratic medicine to a more utilitarian bioethics.
You can meet and hear Wesley Smith making the case for the Hippocratic Oath at the one and only 2019 Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. Attendance is limited to 500. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. Just this morning, I was on a long walk with my grandchildren and my daughter in a very windy small town where I live in southern Illinois. Very rural. You can look in almost any direction and see cornfields in most places in the town, but you also see steeples. You see a steeple here, a steeple there. In just a short walk, just a couple miles, I passed three churches of different Christian denominations, and that was kind of going out of town a little bit. And I think if I started counting them up, I wouldn't actually have to do a lot of counting. I could just look for those steeples as I drove through town. There are no skyscrapers where I live, but the steeples are some among, except for the water tower, among the tallest structures there. There was used to be a reason for that. There still is. What do we make of these buildings that sit there? Some people say they're not paying their property taxes. There is that church taking up all that space with that huge parking lot, and now they're getting ready to expand yet again. How do we understand, how can the media help us understand that relationship there of worship spaces and properties that not only fill our small towns, but our cities as well? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to be talking about media coverage of worship spaces and properties. Terry Mattingly joins us. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate in the book Pop Goes Religion. And he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So you're a reporter. Your editor tells you to write a story about a church that's renovating or making major repairs or maybe even building a new worship space. Where do you go from there?
Well, there are so many issues here and so many different kinds of stories that are related to these physical realities that are churches. Let me just give you a quick spray of kind of a spectrum of things you can go after. One thing is that there's this old saying that church architecture is theology in stone. Well, what they mean by that is you build a church sanctuary to contain the worship of a specific group of people. And how that group of people worships then tells you a lot about their theology. So when theology starts to change, the buildings tend to change. So let me just give you some examples of stories that come out of this. In New York City, one thing that caught my eye was a massive story the other day in the New York Times about Trinity Wall Street, the extremely wealthy, historic parish right across, you know, catty corner from the King's College where I teach in Lower Manhattan. And that place is doing some upgrades, some repairs or whatever, but the church itself is in fantastic shape. And the reason, quite frankly, is because it's so old. It's so old that it's back when they were building churches out of things that lasted. And we can get into that here in a second. Meanwhile, elsewhere in this story, it talked about a lot of churches that are in other parts of New York City that they still think of them as old churches. But these are churches that all date from various parts of the 20th century. And now they're completely falling apart. Some of these churches may look very traditional, but when you go into how they're constructed, they're made out of modern materials, sheetrock, steel. There might be brick or some sort of form stone on the outside, but the interior, the structure of this church was built by the standards of modern America. You can't repair a church that the actual bones of the church are coming apart. Whereas a church that might have been built 200, 300, 500, 700, 1,000 years earlier may still be standing proud. And yeah, you need to fix the roof every once in a while, but nobody's worried about Notre Dame Cathedral falling down because of decay of some sort. Well, now we talk about theology. What's the theology of building a church to last for 1,000 years versus the theology of building a church to last for 40 years? Would you say that there are some value judgments involved in those issues? Well, okay, now let's put it in another modern context. This is one that I just know I've heard from people within the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, that this is very common in your denomination, but I've heard battles at every single level of church life in America over this issue, with the possible exception of Eastern Orthodoxy, but we'll come back to that. Well, what happens when there's part of your church that wants to build a very traditional worship space? They want stone, they want wood, they want something that looks like a church. Then you have other people that maybe they want a very modern design, something that looks kind of trendy and hip, and with it, all kinds of wild corners and great expanses of chrome and glass and something that looks contemporary and speaks to the modern world, quote unquote. Or over in Protestant megachurch land, they want something that looks like a movie theater. Big, huge, curved bowl with space for a rock band and huge screens to put the lyrics to whatever the worship songs are that week that are the new hot ones in town. And in the middle, kind of maybe a glass desk for a pastor who's going to wander around with a cordless mic talking to people. Are there any theological implications of that? Okay, I've just hit you with a bunch of stuff. Does any of that sound familiar to you?
Oh, it sounds very familiar. And I would say that how we build our church building, we would say in Lutheran parlance, it confesses something. How we build our, and that is intended to confess our theology, which is why my objections to big, blank, empty spaces, when we have so much to confess, why not take the opportunity to make that confession permanent in the way you build your church?
Yeah, just make an obvious statement here. A lot of Protestant churches are designed to where the pulpit is centric. I mean, this is a classic Calvinist, Baptist way of setting up a sanctuary. What does that theologically say about the importance of the pulpit? Then, when it comes time for the Lord's Supper, there might be this little table down front that they put leaflets on and stuff like that. And when it's time for the Lord's Supper, they move it out a couple of feet and hang a cloth over it. Or I've seen churches where there's not a table there at all. It's out in the hallway somewhere, and they bring it in the once every couple of months when they do the Lord's Supper. Well, then, kind of easy to contrast that with you walk into an Orthodox church, and here is this massive iconostasis covered with icons and curtains and candles, and then behind that iconostasis is an altar. I mean, and no one even enters this space unless they're either ordained or a part of one of the teams of altar boys or sub-clergy or something. Other than that, it is a holy of holies. Nobody goes in there. Those are two rather different approaches to doing church. Now, in Missouri Synod Lutheran context, do y'all ever have debates about where the altar is and how big it is?
Or whether it is even in there sometimes, but in some churches it's just been replaced with a drum kit. It's
right.
A tragedy, but you know, the picture there, we picture a triangle. At its apex stands the Lord's table. On one other point stands the baptismal font, and then at the other is the place of the word, where God's word is read and
right. Preached.
That is the confession of our sacramental theology there in the architecture of the church.
So what you're seeing there is the theological values of a worship community expressed in architecture. Now, it also says something if the architecture uses classical designs that can be seen in congregations and churches that go back a millennia or larger. Now, these might be slightly modernized, but it makes a difference whether you walk in and you see arches and you see light coming through windows for specific reasons and lighting up specific places, once again, the altar versus whatever else. Then you walk into other churches and it looks like it came out of some sort of, this is my own prejudice speaking here, it looks like it came out of some sort of postmodern National Endowment of the Arts deconstructive grant system. When I was in Russia, I thought it was so fascinating that this was several decades ago, but this was how you could see communism in architecture, this stress on modernity. I live in a town, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where science has kind of ruled this town throughout its existence. And the buildings are just super, super modern. I mean, we have a brutalist architecture library. What does that tell you? I mean, it's, in my opinion, some people think, gosh, that's wonderful looking, it's trendy, it's modern. To me, nothing ages faster than modernity. Modernity changes every 5 to 10 years, and brutalism now just looks like a bunch of concrete with no windows and a lot of weird corners and stuff. Is that what you want to say about books and reading? Yeah, some people, yes, some people, no. Now, what got me interested in writing the column that I've just written about all this were two different things that happened kind of at the same time. One was that New York Times story where it talked about Trinity Wall Street, but then it talked about all of these other churches in New York City that are falling apart. And this is a huge story in New York. Some of these churches are going to have to be torn down. And now in these traditions, like a Methodist church in East Harlem, nobody knows if those worship communities are strong enough to rebuild. They're not strong enough to repair. And then you have other places where you tear it down. Well, can you afford to even think of replacing a church on that site when the real estate property values have escalated so much that you can't even pay for the airspace over that lot somewhere in Harlem? Well, that story stirred me up in a lot of different ways. Then meanwhile, in my own life, here in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, our little Orthodox church, you know, with dozens and dozens of children, we're blowing the walls out. We no longer can meet in our small space. And we have brought in an architect to describe the process of building an Orthodox sanctuary in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. This very interesting artist and man, Andrew Gould, runs a company dedicated to Byzantine arts in the modern world. And we showed him around Oak Ridge and he laughed and said, well, if you were going to build a stainless steel flying saucer church, Oak Ridge is where you would build it. Talking about the relentless emphasis on science and modernity in our town. He said, but that's not what the Orthodox want. The Orthodox want to build a church that's going to last 1,000 years. While the standards of the American construction industry is that you're supposed to build a church that will last 40 to 50 years. Are there any theological implications to those statements?
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of worship spaces and properties. When we come back, he says in his On Religion column that church architecture is personal. We'll find out what he means by that. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, the book Pop Goes Religion.
Town. Chicago is.
The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference is coming to Chicago for its one and only 2019 conference. You can meet and hear Ross Douthat, Matt Harrison, Wesley Smith, Aaron Wolf, Hans Feeney, and Will Whedon Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Lutheran Women's Missionary League is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During March, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to the LWML. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Hey, Todd. What have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about media coverage of worship spaces and properties. Terry Mattingly is our guest. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. So, Terry, you had said in your column that church architecture is personal. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's personal, like I said earlier, in that it reflects the personal beliefs, convictions, and values of the people who built that church, or that people who are worshiping in it at the moment and want to change it, or they want to build a new church. It's personal for me in that my own congregation is going through this process right now. And let me just give you another example, and I'm going to do this. I'm a teacher. I ask questions. So I'm testing you again very briefly. I'm sure that your pastoral experience will have told you the answer to this. Which do you think would be more expensive? A church built out of classic masonry, stucco, exposed timber, and rock, or a church built out of sheetrock, steel constructions, and kind of a thin layer of brick?
Well, I guess the second.
The second is much less expensive.
In the short term.
In the short term. But if the construction industry of your culture says you build buildings, anything, you build a building that will last 40 to 50 years, that's kind of what you do. Now, what's really, this is where things begin to get philosophical. The interesting thing is you can build something that looks just like an Orthodox church out of materials that are going to last 40 to 50 years. It's going to look the same. It's going to have a dome. The outside of it's going to look like brick and maybe some wood and maybe some stucco. And you go inside and there might be some form stone and some other stuff. And it's all going to look like an Orthodox church. But 40 to 50 years from now, you're going to be building again. Well, but that's less expensive. We, modern Americans, we can afford to do that now. Well, what if you wanted to build a church that was made out of timber and rock and real live masonry and stuff like that. And you're going to put this church up and you're going to do a few repairs, but you know that Orthodox Christians are going to be worshiping in that sanctuary at this spot for generations to come. Now, it's going to cost more. But do you see now that there's beginning to be a value statement in those two options?
Well, is that a good question for a reporter to ask? I mean, in addition to like, what's this thing standing here, or why is the altar there, or something like that, but ask the question, why did you guys decide to build out of these kind of more permanent, not only in terms of their construction value, but also in terms of their cultural value materials?
Yeah. Well, reporters will care because we're talking money. I mean, so you're going to build a church that holds 200 people, and it's going to cost twice as much. That's interesting. I know in certain traditions, I've heard people say that church building projects have been called pastor killers or preach killers because of kind of the arm twisting involved in raising the money to do these projects. So there's quite a bit of stress involved in raising the money to build a building of this sort. But let me just give you a comparison. Another church that's in the news right now, because incidentally it's related to the Theodore McCarrick story. If you're ever driving on the interstate across western Kansas from Kansas City to Denver, way, way, way out in western Kansas, you begin to see something very strange coming at the horizon over you. And it turns out it is a church called the Cathedral of the Plains. Now, here you are in a town with maybe 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people max. What are they doing with a full-fledged brick, stone, timber, massive Romanesque cathedral? You know, with bell towers that go up 5-6 stories into the air that can be seen from 50 miles away coming across the plain if you get the right angle on them. Why did this area of farmers from Germany, why did people for 50 to 60 miles around, sure, they had their local tiny little Catholic churches, but to them it was a statement of their Catholic faith. We need a cathedral. We need a cathedral because we're Catholics. And we need a basilica worthy of when our bishop comes, and when we do worship of certain kinds. Now, I mention this simply to say, I think it's a fascinating commentary on America that peasants and farmers in parts of Europe, parts of Greece, parts of Russia, parts of Romania, Serbia, built magnificent cathedrals out of stone and timber and the finest materials they could get their hands on, whereas American suburbanites, wealthy beyond belief, may struggle to build what for many people in other parts of the world is a perfectly normal church. Values of how much money we invest into and the beauty of a sanctuary says something about our values, as well as do questions about, you know, building a school, building a Hellenic center, building a gymnasium. Lots of churches now spend as much money on their gymnasium as they do on their sanctuary. There are churches that use both buildings for the same purpose. Every single one of these statements I'm making to you has theological content and content about the values of the people in that congregation. It may take a little bit of creativity on the part of a reporter, but I guarantee you, if you go in there and talk to the people in those congregations, I've heard people do everything but throw hymnals at each other over the color of the carpet in a church. A member of my family was once a part of a Baptist church that almost split over the issue of whether or not to include a dove descending on the River Jordan in a stained glass window representing the baptism of Jesus, because they were afraid that would be too charismatic. Because charismatic controversies were touching the church in a number of different ways. Does this make any sense? Every single layer of this has got interesting stories in it, if you know how to look at them.
Someone whom Terry has mentioned several times that we should all be following is New York Times columnist Ross Douthat. He'll be speaking at our one and only 2019 Making the Case Conference June 7th and 8th in Chicago. Attendance is limited to 500. Early bird registration is before April 1st. And it's $115. That also includes three meals. Thanks to the Lutheran Church Extension Fund sponsorship, childcare is free. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. Making the Case, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
In Hour 2 of Issues Etc., Dr. John Warwick Montgomery will be our guest. We're going to talk about a recent decision by the European Court of Human Rights regarding blasphemy against Muhammad.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.